Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Well, this evening for this fireside chat for the OACA Interprofessional Internship Program, I'm delighted to have Dean Mays, Dean Molgaard, and AVP Daniels with us. I think it'll be an exciting, interesting conversation. I'm sure it will be. And I'll get us started by, well, first just saying hi to the interns. I know you're busy. I know it's a crazy time of the semester. It's a crazy time in our city and in our country. And I acknowledge all of that this evening. I hope that this can be a time to be encouraged, to take a deep breath and just kind of listen to a few stories, ask a few questions, and leave hopefully inspired and encouraged and thought-provoked in one way or another. So first, Dean Mays, welcome. We'd love to have you briefly just introduce yourself and tell us how you're taking care of yourself these days.
So I'm Dr. Keith Mays, and I am the interim dean of the dental school. Taking care of oneself, taking care of myself is, as you introduce things this evening, it has been a little bit of a daily struggle at times. Being candid, you go through anger, frustration, and dismay that this is really happening. I'm a person of faith. So one of my ways to take care of myself is prayer. And I think the other thing that I do is I'm an avid fitness person. So I run to my home gym for refuge. And there's also, YouTube, King Charles Cavalier, puppy videos that, also make you smile, along with some, 90 sitcoms from Netflix. So that's kind of my whole world, and how I maintain sanity.
Thank you, Dean Mays. Appreciate that. That was a lot of tips all in one. Wonderful. Dean Molgaard, how are you this evening? A little bit about yourself and how you're taking care of yourself.
Thank you. My name is Laura Molgaard. I'm the interim dean at the College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm a veterinarian by training. And how am I taking care of myself? For me, a lot of it has been not on a day like today where I have had back-to-back Zoom meetings all day and it's 36 degrees, but on many days in each part of the year, each season, I try to get outdoors with my dogs. They need it, I need it, and that kind of reconnecting with the outdoors has been a major factor for me in maintaining my optimism, honestly. The other part, I think, is learning, continuing to learn and really stretching myself to learn about new things. So whether that be around social justice or strategic planning or other important skill sets that I haven't had as much chance to develop previously in my career, I'm making that a priority now.
Thanks, Dean Molgaard. And AVP Daniels, thank you for joining this panel as well. Tell us about yourself and how you're taking care of yourself these days. Let me unmute you. I think you're muted still. Thanks.
Learning how to fix the mute button is chore one here. So I think about the answer to that question in two different ways. I like to think of my career as being a joy. And so figuring out how It brings joy and solves problems and is an integral part of my life is just really key. In addition to that, we have a new golden retriever puppy that's keeping our whole family exceptionally busy. One of the unintended joys for me is reconnecting with my 30-ish year old kids who are spending more time with us now than had been the case before.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. So normally I have a little list of questions that I can jump to and engage some of our panelists. I want to just pause and look at you, the interns, and acknowledge that you're all in different spaces and places right now today. We have a few dental interns. We certainly have a vet med intern, interns from liberal arts, from nursing, from public health, from a variety of programs. This is your shot at your deans and an AVP who ran a $500 million clinical enterprise at one point, or probably grew it to that. So any reflections from any of you, any question right off the bat that you would love to pose to the group?
I'll jump in with a question. Hi, my name is Tara Dillon. I'm a Master of Nursing student. And one of the questions I thought about in advance was, how all of you are working to bring trauma-informed components into your leadership right now. And I think that really ties to the question of how you're all taking care of yourselves. So would love to hear how you're thinking about taking care of your teams and your organizations as well.
Thanks so much, Tara. And I'll open it up to whomever would like to go first in answering that.
I can start. I think I'll use an example of re-entry that we have to do in the summer and in the fall. Because I run a teaching enterprise and a clinical enterprise, we've been in the clinics from a physical position at 50% capacity. So we've used half our chairs in order to stretch social distance to an appropriate place. That's challenged us because it's less opportunities for students. And so we want to start to open that up. And so we talked about how do we open that up. And the provost announcing that we'll be back 100% in person in the fall. When I approached my clinical dean and talked about opening it up, he basically said, I'd like to just open it up wide open. I said, no. I said, you know, you all haven't been around each other for a year. It's like, you can't just come back together. You got to get used to each other again. And so I think it's just an awareness in helping people understand that, we do have to respect each other's boundaries. We do have to take it slow. We do have to think about people. We need to think about who may not want to come back. And if they don't want to come back, how do we adjust for that? Not anything bad on them, just how do we adjust our environment for that? So I think for me as a leader is just keeping the focus in some of those places on how do we run our business versus looking down on somebody who would not want to come back because they're afraid or they're nervous or anything. That's human emotions and things. Fine. We still have to run. So we focus on that and try to shift away from the other aspect and just try to really lend space for just human behavior. You know, I don't feel good. I don't want to be here. You know, I'm nervous. All those things are fair for us to feel. As an organization, you know, as a dean, I have to run these enterprises and somehow I have to run the enterprise and give you the space to have those true feelings. That's a balance in which I receive and accept how you feel because that's real. And I keep doing the business of the school.
Thanks, Keith. Bobby or Laura?
Well, I think to build on that, I mean, I'll give you an example of something I did just this morning. And so I've been working with the Community University Healthcare Center, which is basically owned by the university and provides care to a lot of a very diverse population in the Phillips neighborhood. And in addition to that, the Mobile Health Initiative, which reaches out across the state to provide care to patients and individuals, you know, closer to where they live. And in both of those cases, they're very affected by what is likely to happen, regardless of the verdict, in the Chauvin trial. And so today, we work to facilitate the people who wanted to have an activist role after the verdict was announced, and figure out ways to keep them safe. We talked about ways to protect the Community University Healthcare Center. By boarding up the windows, which had to be done before. And I also worked with the CEO of KOOK to help facilitate some of the things that she was doing with her staff. And so I think there's just a broad variety of ways that at this particular time, depending on people's perspective, you have to facilitate what the people who you are leading need. And in this case, that was what I was doing. A little different from what Keith is doing. And I'm sure, Laura, you have an even more different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just no getting around the fact that this past 12, 13 months has been incredibly hard for people, and for so many different reasons. One of the things that I've been doing is to remind the leaders on my team how there is no one perspective of what it's like to work within the College of Veterinary Medicine right now. So for example, being really more inclusive in our language. So instead of saying, well, we know that this has been really hard for everybody to work from home, acknowledging that some of us are working from home and are dealing with those challenges. Others have been seeing a record case volume on the clinic floor and have been, in addition to just the sheer exhaustion that creates working 14, 16 hour days, I heard from one of our faculty in emergency and critical care over the weekend. But also then needing to turn patients away. When the ICU fills up, we have to shut down receiving because we can't care for any, we need to continue to care for the patients that are already there. So this has been a really, really hard time for people. And so I do think it begins with empathy and begins with listening. It begins with asking, not assuming that I know. I might think I know what's going on in a particular situation, but at the same time, it is also about balancing that empathy with holding people accountable for taking care of themselves and taking care of each other. Individuals react differently to the kinds of pressures that people are under. Some are more likely to kind of turn inward and struggle to take care of their own well-being, and others are more likely to kind of lash out, blame, quote, throw somebody under the bus. And it can be a real challenge to balance in that conversation the assuming positive intent, but also talking about the impact that behavior may have had on others. So there isn't any one approach because the experience within the various parts of our college are so different, and the experiences of the individuals, students, faculty, and staff within those areas is also very depending on what might be going on in their home community and how, for example, the curfew affects somebody who lives in this part of the Twin Cities versus that part of the Twin Cities. Just really being open to recognizing that that difference and to listening to and then, I guess, validating that experience.
Thanks, Laura. And thanks all three of you. I like how Bobby put it, facilitating what people need. And in thinking about what it means to trauma-informed lead or trauma-informed care, we just received three very distinct examples of how that's being lived out. As a forensic clinician who does trauma-informed care every day in my practice, bringing it home or bringing it to the research team or the other teams I work on, that doesn't always come naturally. Really comes naturally with patients, but how do we live that out with our colleagues? That's a different scenario, and we've heard some good examples of that from these three. So thank you. We have a question in the chat box about DEI, and of course, all the initiatives that are happening in your respective schools around diversity, equity, inclusivity. I guess I would pose the question to all of you as far as what you'd like to offer to these up and coming leaders, folks who are leading as interns, leading as graduate students about to enter the workforce, maybe a challenge to them or an encouragement as they're coming into positions that might bring them on pathways toward positions you're in. What should they focus on when it comes to diversity and equity and inclusivity? What advice would you give to them?
I guess I'll start. I think that this is a lifelong learning, a perfect example of lifelong learning in the health professions. That I think that taking advantage of or creating those opportunities for personal learning and continuous personal learning is critical. And then providing those opportunities as you move through your career to work with others in advancing that understanding of moving along that developmental trajectory. And I like the IDI model, the intercultural development inventory model, that sort of starts with, it's a developmental model rather than a judgmental model, starting with polarization, that some folks within our organizations are going to be starting at polarization. Others might be a little bit further along the developmental trajectory of minimization, which is, you know, we're all the same when it comes down to it, to having a deeper understanding of how to work across differences, recognize that my perspective is informed by my lived experience and my culture. That was something that took me, I was not as young as I would like to say when I suddenly kind of had that aha. I really looked at myself as working or living from a place that really didn't have a culture. And then that's just clearly not true. To not understand that culture of whiteness and what that means is, I can't be as effective if I don't really understand where I'm coming from, to be able to then be respectful and empathetic and understanding of where another person or others in the group might be coming from in making a decision or guiding a policy or whatever might be happening within the organization. That so I guess that's my advice.
Thank you. Bobby or Keith, to add?
This is like a hugely deep question. even your adaptation. For me, at least, the complexity of what, you know, to advise would be to really, I think, tee off right from where Laura left is to take inventory of where you're at and what you're thinking and what you know and what you don't know, and then begin to really investigate and inquire about policies and systems and how things came to be. There's a great book that I'm halfway into it, and is the political determinants of health. It blew me away because it was this just what felt like to me, at least, this endless series of legislations that didn't get voted on, and therefore historically underrepresented folk and poor folk didn't have health insurance. And it just shows that how much the system has constructed these barriers, and then how we have falsely codified them into you deserve, you don't deserve, or you did the right thing, you didn't do the right thing. Not really appreciating that even if you tried, you couldn't have done the right thing. And so I think DEI is just incredibly complex because of all of these things. And then you do have to go about thinking really seriously, how do you unravel it? How do you reframe it? How do you shuffle the deck? Because again, one of the things that the Dean Mogart mentioned is dependent upon where people are at, folk are not ready for this. And you really have to, that's one of the big lessons learned for me as a leader is, even if I can see 20 steps down the road, if my team can only go to step 3, there's no way for me to go to 20 today. And I have to appreciate that and try to do the things that'll put me in a position to get to 20, but I can't take people who can only go to 4 to 20 today. And so in DEI, it's very serious, and these are very deep. These are deeply rooted, longstanding, sometimes decades and generations of thoughts and philosophies and ideas. And it's, you know, I think it's really, you know, you look at where you're at, you look at your sphere of influence, you look at your development training, where you're at and what you can do, and you do that thing. And if there's something else that you want to do that you're not trained for, then you equip yourself to do that thing. But you do what you can where you're at now, and don't wait for anybody else to start it.
Thank you, Keith. Bobby, anything to add?
Well, I mean, I would agree with both of what Keith and Laura said. You know, I think if you come at it from an individual level, and Keith was mentioning that just a couple seconds ago, you have to take the blinders off, and you have to get rid of assumptions that you thought were right, but they probably aren't, and gaining that perspective. You know, if the millennials and Generation Z, X, or Y, you know, I mean, I had no concept of that. And then I started talking to my adult kids, and then you start to realize just how complicated even that is. And then thinking about reaching out into rural Minnesota, where DEI is very much an issue there, but it's cast through a different prism. And so I think you just have to be very alert, have your antenna up, and be willing to search your soul and figure out where you're at, and what the community that you're needing or you're serving might need. And you have to listen to that community. You can't assume.
Thank you. Really great reflections. I'm going to take us in a different direction, lighten us up just for a minute. So I'd love for each of you to share a story, looking back on your lives, looking back on your careers and your professions. You entered your profession, and at some point you were on a team or in a team, because none of us have practiced by ourselves. We've all practiced with team. Share a story or a memory of some of those first teams, things gone really great or things just gone awry. usually we come up with the gonorrhea stories quicker than the great stories.
Yeah, I was going to start there.
Yeah.
Go for it.
I owned a practice, my wife and I, and we bought a practice that had a small, it was a bad purchase. My financial brain and risk tolerance has grown so much from that mistake. I'd have never made it again. It was just basically you bought practice and you thought you bought patients, but you really didn't buy patients. And so we pretty much had a few patients, maybe 40 that should have been 300, and just started growing the practice and started hiring. We get the receptionist and then we get the assistant and then the assistant wants to be the receptionist. And then they get upset with us and then they leave. And then we get another assistant and then we get a second assistant and then they're not getting along with each other. And so it was just this initial thing was really trying to get like, can y'all just work? You know, we're just trying to get more patients in here and get things flowing. But, you know, really kind of building a team and getting people to do the things that interact in that fashion for that first round was hard. And I'm a fairly big team person. And I think that piece, I just thought everybody else would come together in that way. And now I'm much more intentional about looking at people and seeing if they're doing that and not doing that and how to build that in. But at that point, I just thought people understood you got to work together. And then, no, that's not what's going to happen. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Thank you for that example, for sure. Bobby, Laura?
Well, I can give an example like that. And it wasn't, I'd say it wasn't really early in my career, but when I was the CEO of University of Minnesota Physicians, I put together a team and I intentionally tried to break down some of the typical stereotypes in medicine. And so, each person who was on the team was truly outstanding in and of his own right, her own right. And it was an exceptionally diverse group, but it turned out no one could get along. The CFO and the COO basically hated each other. And I'm not sure that that's too, and they still do to this very day. The CMO didn't really like working with the CFO. I would support what Dean May said. I mean, you don't underestimate just how difficult it is to get people to work together, even when individually they have incredible skills and a lot to offer. It's really a challenge. But it's so important, and especially in healthcare, because healthcare it's a team sport.
I'll build off that, to this day, and then I'll share an early career one. Some team members see their role as to sort of observe and report, meaning to tell you what so-and-so did that just bothered them. And that is a challenging dynamic to try to shift, that we're all responsible for working together as a team, and a tremendously important leadership or team competency is to work with people that are challenging for you. In vet school admissions, one of the questions we ask is a behavioral event question. We all have to work with difficult people. Tell us about a time when you had to build a relationship with someone with whom you initially didn't get along. And I mean, that is true. We might think that we will luck into a situation where everybody gets along well, but that is very often not good idea, wrong species, right? Humans don't tend to do that very well. So I'll tell a lighthearted, I think this kind of lighthearted example from when I was very early in practice. I probably looked like I was about 12 years old. I was quite young. I was in my 20s, but I look back at those pictures and I looked about 12 years old. And so here I am practicing in rural Pennsylvania. Moved from the Midwest out to Pennsylvania just for kind of an adventure, new place. And the clients there just could not believe that I was one of the veterinarians or doctors. So the client would come into the room and say, well, when the doctor comes in, I'd really like him to look in the ears. Like, reintroduce myself. I am the doctor. I am looking in the ears. And here's what I think we need to do. Well, when the doctor comes in, I'd like him to. So, and then that would be compounded by the team that I had, these veterinary technicians who, if you're not familiar with veterinary practice, are to some extent the equivalent of the nurses of the veterinarian who are providing the care, patient care. And if I would need help with something, I would call out into the exam room, hey, can I get a hand in here? And the techs would be sitting around the counter and would, the slow clap, ha, 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 you're not going to get me to come in and help you there. So that was a real awakening for me as someone who made it all the way through school without, I think, the word team ever being mentioned once. There wasn't group work back then. There was no attention paid to, team skills and having to navigate those kinds of challenges with zero playbook. So I'm a big fan of the fact that we now talk about things like team steps and other strategies that people can fall back on when it's not coming naturally.
Thanks, Laura. Anyone want to pop in with a question or comment at this point?
Can I ask about your experiences on interprofessional teams?
Go for it.
Just kind of like how, when you guys talk about, we're talking about teamwork, like in your own field, this was the experiences you had, the good and the bad, but what about when you started working with people outside of your career field?
Sure. I'll jump in there first. First of all, one of the things I found fascinating being a part of interprofessional education for the last decades at the University of Minnesota is that how we categorize what's uniprofessional and interprofessional is fascinating to me. So for example, it's sort of automatic that MDs and nurses are seen as interprofessional if they're working together, but a dental hygienist and a dentist is seen as uniprofessional, or a veterinary technician, a veterinarian is seen as uniprofessional. So even the definitions are fascinating to me. But I would say that my experience working in interprofessional teams tends to be less around patient care and more around kind of big systems things. And then I will say that I've had the absolute privilege to be at the University of Minnesota, where I get to work with just phenomenal people from across the health professions that are bringing their A game with really interesting and unique perspectives to whatever the challenges that we're trying to address. And so I have had very positive interprofessional experiences. I would say the exception to that would be on interprofessional teams where there isn't a clear understanding of roles. If you think about interprofessional education, part of it's about learning about each other's roles so that we can know what the roles each of us can play. And sometimes there have been assumptions about, the role of the veterinarian being something like, well, you'd probably take care of the birds in the aviary in the waiting room. That would be your role in the interprofessional team, rather than what can you tell us about biosecurity, infection control, public health, end of life conversations, et cetera, the things that maybe are more where the veterinarian can lend some greater use.
I think for me, it was, so I had two experiences or two practice times in which I was in the hospital. One we have in dentistry called general practice residency. So it's a 1 or 2 year program that's after dental school. So I did a program like that. And one of the things that I was interested in was treating oral cancer patients. And so so I would get engaged in that as a resident. You know, as a resident, you're lowly, so it doesn't matter which profession you are. But got along with people. The next was when I was actually the assistant director of a GPR program and treating oral cancer patients, and would work with an oral surgeon, radiation oncologist, sometimes ENT and other folks to do my part to rehabilitate hyperbaric oxygen folk. To rehabilitate people's oral cavity after maxillectomies and you know, people taking half of the mandible away. Those were, we were pretty good because it was kind of critical. You had a cancer patient who had this 5 centimeter tumor, and you know, they had to create a big hole in somebody in the roof of their mouth, and then I had to create a prosthesis that was going to plug that hole, allow them to eat and speak, and have some kind of good aesthetics. And so we worked together pretty good and had our signals pretty good to make that happen. And so for that team, it was really good. It was a few folk that I work with, and we managed our patients kind of well. When I transitioned in another environment, it didn't have that same sense of team and sense of people and kind of, you know, you do this, I do that, and you know, you call me then, and I, you know, when those things were lost, it totally didn't work the same. And it was actually part of why I stopped practicing. Because I didn't have that same sense that I had once had.
Well, so just to build on that, I think that one of the challenges in healthcare is how to do things better and in a more innovative way. And I think actually one of the reasons I went into healthcare was something I saw, I joke 100 years ago, but a long time ago, where a very innovative pharmacist who had a connection to a nursing home decided that PharmDs, people who had doctorates in pharmacy, should be the ones advising the nursing home and managing all of the medications that all of the nursing home patients received. And the patient care improved so much. But at that time, it was an incredibly innovative model because what pharmacists were doing in most places was counting out pills, which they really don't even do anymore. And so as you think about interprofessional, it isn't just who sits next to you, which is important, but it's how you interact with them and how you actually impact the care of the patients that you're trying to help or the system that you're trying to help. And I'd urge you to think beyond the traditional health science schools because you know, at the University of Minnesota, nutrition is in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Nutrition. And that I think is key to health. The built environment is incredibly important to health and also an important part of how you do rehab and things like that. At the University of Minnesota, that's in the College of Design. And so think outside of your comfort zone as you think about ways to solve the problems that you're going to be facing throughout your entire career. There's a tremendous amount of talent in places where you might not realize there's the interest.
Thanks, Bobby. That feeds pretty nicely into this other question that's been raised in the chat box with respect to integration. And it also speaks a bit to the previous question just about paving the way for something new and different when others might be more comfortable with the status quo. So I'll let you all think about it for a minute, just some reflections on bringing these new innovations and ideas. strategies for these interns as they're coming into practice with ideas, with thoughts about how better to do things, with a lot of comfort with social media and some of the technologies and wearables, for example. And then just generally also this question of integrating oral health and medicine. There's a dental faculty who is one of my favorite people over there who reminds everybody in any meeting that the mouth is a part of the body. And I know Dean Mays knows who I'm talking about.
Yes, I know Dr. Quick.
Yeah, but it's true. It's true. And, you know, what does the future of healthcare look like? And what can you as future leaders do? Building on some of the experiences of our colleagues here. Any reflections from Laura, Bobby, or Keith? I know I've just combined a bunch of these questions. So go ahead and just look at the chat box and decide which one or pieces you'd like to reflect on.
Yeah, I'd like to tee up the integration one. So I think I'll use a great example and it's my example, Kaiser Permanente. So Kaiser Permanente has a clinic that is a medical dental integration clinic. And it is a beautiful model of what can be. And so essentially there's oral health professionals and physicians in the same suite, maybe around the corner, different ends of the hallway. If someone's coming in for an extraction and blood pressure is, you know, 170 over 250, you know, you don't have to send them back home. You just go get your colleague around the corner and you figure out if you really need to do this another day or if there's some, you know, something we can do medically right now and take care of that. In the same way, we used to have medicine management. We used to have pharmacy come into our clinic. If pharmacy's in the clinic, you can do the same thing when you're reviewing people's medications. I think there is an awesome lane for this to happen. And I think Kaiser Permanente has kind of set it up really simply, really easy. I think one of the things that's challenging is when we talk about it in a lot of ways, we talk about scope of practice. And we talk about scope of practice in a scary way. And essentially, you know, I don't mind screening for diabetes and screening for hypertension, but I don't want to be a physician. And so I can screen and still not be a physician. But if I say that I want to do those things for some physician, it may be scary. And vice versa for oral health. And so it's just a way of really talking about how we do this. What is the scope of practice? I forget Qualis, Q-U-A-L-I-S, has a great figure of interprofessional care. And pretty much there's in the Venn diagram shape in the center are the things that we do and the other things are on the outside. And so I gave a talk last year, gave a great example of managing diabetes in which perio and diabetes are connected periodontal disease and diabetes are connected. And therefore that's a zone in which they can do things together. But I'm pretty sure the physician doesn't want to deal with putting crowns on. And I don't want to deal with, you know, taking out a gallbladder. And so, but that middle ground is where we can share scopes and not cross the line. So I think there's a nice sweet spot for it to occur. We just have to kind of say, we really want to do this. And we're not trying to step on each other's toes.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Keith. Bobby or Laura?
Well, I think referring back to something that Laura said earlier, you know, if you look at that, so just taking Keith's analogy about the overlap, sometimes that overlap might not be so obvious. But I've heard from some of Laura's faculty very compelling stories about the ability of people from the vet school to influence how human end of life care is provided, for example. And I actually think that veterinarians are probably trained and much more understanding of that than a lot of the other health professions. And so I think it goes back to opening up your eyes and your ears and really, you know, thinking about the opportunities. And there are tons of opportunities where I think most people don't even realize. We have more in common than we do differences, probably both within the health sciences and in the world in general. But
thanks, Bobby. I agree 100%. Laura.
Sorry, it was noisy here, but like just got someone to shut my door. you know, veterinarians don't work as a part of the human patient care team, and we never probably will. But, you know, what are the opportunities? What is the cost of not including all of these different perspectives and bringing to the table what these different perspectives can lend, I guess, is one way to look at it. So, you know, there are care models and there are payment models and there are practice acts and there are all these things that dictate how we work. But if we come at it from the other angle rather than what can't we do and think about, well, what could we do or what would be possible if we really were designing new approaches, I will say, I guess, sort of a generic term, with the end in mind of the quadruple aim, what would that look like? And we can't change the systems overnight. And we may not be in the position to change the systems at all, but we can think about how we interact and how we learn from each other and how we can advance individual health, population health, and you know, learn from what each profession does best. What does each profession do that it's uniquely suited to do? What kinds of problems is each profession uniquely able to solve, rather than what body part or species do we work on?
Thanks, Laura. All right, I'm going to move us toward the two final questions, I think, for the time that we have remaining. And one is from Mariah. Thank you, Mariah, for that one. That's in the chat box, which is actually a couple questions. But really, it's about the right time, the right place. And it fuels off from one of our previous sessions where one of our panelists said he just took advantage of almost every opportunity that came across his path. And, you know, I know our current grad students are being told, you know, discern what you say yes to. Don't say yes to everything. Say no, set boundaries. And then they're also being told, say yes to everything because you never know what's going to pan out. So for the three of you, are there any examples from your own career where you were at the right time and right place, or you were very intentional about the path you chose when you were at a crossroads? And then there's this follow-up question Mariah posed, which is about when you've felt like you were over your head. You took a role that maybe you were over your head with, and how did you overcome that feeling, those feelings? So right time, right place, turning points, forks in the road, you know, maybe a story or an example about that. And if you want to address the feeling over your head sometimes, any of those tips are probably going to be welcomed as well. And then I still have a final question, so let's see where we go. All right, Laura.
I'll be brief. I think imposter syndrome is huge. It's common, it's normal, and it's important to just recognize that it is what it is. It's imposter syndrome. So have there been times where I felt like I was in over my head? Yes, every single time I felt like I was in over my head. Every single time I made a change, whether that was just graduating from school and starting practice, or leaving practice and going into teaching, or leaving this institution and going to that institution, or taking on a new role, every single time I sometimes feel it in over my head, and I have to remind myself that learning new things is hard, and that you know, using the skills and strategies that helped me succeed before can help me succeed again, with, of course, all kinds of new tweaks learned along the way. One of the tools that I think is maybe would be of interest to this group is mindfulness. You know, just becoming uncomfortable with discomfort, noticing this is uncomfortable. What is this discomfort telling me? Is this something I need to do something about? I think the same can be true about those sort of decisions, those inflection points. Really being able to notice those kinds of messages that are in our heads and decide which ones we're going to listen to and what strategies we want to choose to move forward, whether that is choosing to say yes or choosing to say no. But I think that's pretty essential in healthcare and different people to approach this differently. So I'm not advocating for any particular approach. Like Dean Mays said, prayer, other people, it looks like something else, but ways to calmly and quietly reflect without letting that feeling of feeling overwhelmed be what drives our behavior, because that is a feeling and feelings tend to come and go. So becoming fluent in how to navigate our inner world as well as our outer world.
Thanks, Lauren. Thank you for the candor and calling out imposter syndrome, which many, many people do experience. And thank you for giving some concrete skills and strategies and not just saying you use skills and strategies. That was very helpful. Bobby or Keith?
Yes, overwhelmed, yes. I think that, a great friend of mine, who's no longer with us, at one point when I kind of had a feeling like this, gave me some quote. This guy read everything in the world, but I don't know where he got it from, but he said, when your world gets big around you, you have to get big in your world. And it's one of those things, you say, what? but it's true. And what was interesting is this really connects with what Laura's saying, is that you do have to check yourself and why you're feeling the way you're feeling, because what he said I had done before, but in this particular situation, I felt more overwhelmed, so I couldn't adapt to it as quickly. But essentially, you do, when things around you are bigger than what you think you may be, then you have to do some learning, you have to do some reading. I believe in calling a friend. So I have people that I reach out to and say, what about this? And so, you just have to respect that there are gonna be times when it just is like, I don't really know what this is about. And that just does happen. And I wanted to address the first, what was the first part of your question, Carolyn? Because I wanted, it was.
The right time, right place, or career.
Oh, choice. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that you have to know what you want to do more than anybody else. Because I'll give an example. I was, so I did a PhD as a faculty member, and I submitted a grant, and I was advised, that the grant was okay, but the grant wasn't okay from a faculty member standpoint. It was probably okay from a graduate student standpoint, but when the reviewers read it, they added in, this person is a faculty. And so the reviews came back harder. And then the person who was talking with me and counseling me said, yes, this is what they did. I don't know why, but that's what they did. And so I took something away from that lesson. And I realized that I was a PhD student, but I was a faculty member. And so I had to behave as a faculty member. I didn't have a choice. It was harder work, but I didn't have a choice. And so one of the things that happened was an opportunity to be on a thesis committees for residents. And that same person said, you know, you shouldn't do this. You're doing your PhD. You know, there'll be plenty of time for this down the road. And I just looked at him and I just said, thank you. Yes. Walked away and kept serving because I had already framed what I was going to do. And faculty members get a review every year and you have to put down the things that you do. And being on the serving as a thesis advisor or committee member is one of those things. So I knew what I was doing. He didn't. And I didn't have time to break him down and tell him. But you have to know what you're trying to do more than anybody else. Because people don't understand where you're trying to go or exactly how you're trying to do it. And you have to know that. And then that allows you to kind of analyze the advice that people are giving.
Thank you.
And I wasn't rude to him. I was very polite.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bobby.
Well, my career was much more serendipitous and probably not as planful as you would read in the books. And so I feel like I just stayed true to what I wanted, kind of like Keith was talking about, and ended up in a good spot. I think, though, the question about being in over your head and overcoming that is a really important one, because I think sometimes when people are new in leadership positions, they feel like they need to do everything themselves, and asking for help is not acceptable. And actually, it's just the contrary. As a leader, you need to take input from everyone, and by everyone, that can be, well, in a day when we're doing things in person, the person who is walking around a new potential recruit, who might be the clerical person in the office, but might be the source of the most interesting information about the candidate, you know, all the way to major crises where you have to both manage up and manage down. So don't feel like you're in a leadership position by yourself. It's kind of like being in healthcare. There's a team. You can't provide healthcare without a team. You can't be a leader without a team. And it's all levels of the team that are important.
Thanks, Bobby. I resonate with so much of everything that all of these colleagues have been saying and sharing tonight. And I hope that it's been encouraging to all of you as interns. As we wrap up in the last 3 minutes, about a minute for each person, I'd love for you to share your go-to podcast or your go-to book, your go-to favorite Twitter follower or music you play when you're about to scream. What are some of your favorites that you just would pass on? It could be a quote like Dean Mays had shared as well. I'll give you a second to think, and whoever's ready, just jump on in.
I'll jump in. Podcast Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantin. And this is an oldie, but it's just come in handy so many times I have to pick it. Crucial Conversations is the book that I think has underpinned my work with students, work with faculty, work with other leaders. It's packed with good stuff.
Thanks, Laura.
I would say, so podcasts, there are two, and I haven't done really many in the last year. But TED Talks, just go on and look for something based on how I'm feeling that moment. And Truth for Life is a ministry podcast. And so those are two that I kind of go to. Music, it's if I'm really at that place, it's some 1980s, 70 serious groove, you know, that I can play loud and just buzz out for a minute.
That's awesome. I won't put it in the chat box, but that's awesome. Bobby, how about you?
Well, this is where my age probably shows, because I'm not sure I've ever listened to a podcast. Wouldn't know how to use a Twitter account.
Oh gosh.
So that's probably pretty pathetic to all of you. But in times of stress and crisis, I just like to get lost in something completely different. And it's amazing how many times you can do something like read an opinion piece in the New York Times or, you know, the Atlantic or whatever, and learn something really different, but yet applicable to the problem that you're trying to solve. So I'm easily distracted during those moments.
Thank you. Thanks, Bobby. And thanks for your time this evening, all of you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.